Hello and welcome to another episode of Wise Women, The Vicar of the Witch with Susie Crockford, she's the witch, and Maggie Whitehouse, she's the vicar, that'll be me. Today we have the second half of my interview with Susie for Unity Online Radio. Enjoy.
Susie, one of the things we've been talking about lately, and you did a talk about in Exeter quite recently, was the witch wound. Now, the feminine, the darkness, has been seen as dangerous for a long, long time, probably because of this intuition. Can you describe for us what the witch wound actually is?
So for me, the witch wound is that part of us, and by us I mean all of us, whatever shape, body we're in, that says that it is dangerous, literally life-threatening, to connect deeply with our intuition, with the spirits of the land, with our knowings of every kind, with our communions and our consanguinity with all things. Because if we do, maybe somebody will call us a witch, and still there is still such an enormous fear, I think, in all of us, that says that being called a witch is potentially life-threatening, even though the Witchcraft Act was in the United Kingdom was repealed in something like 1748 or something, and interestingly was replaced with an act saying that it was now a crime to pretend to be a witch, because by that time the thinking was that, of course, no one was really a witch. I notice it even in myself, just every now and then there'll be this kind of, you know, what if they're the kind of person who really thinks witches are bad people in service to the supposed devil, what will happen to me? And I believe it's present in all of us, because all of us are connected to the feminine and to that intuition, and all of us are connected to the masculine, which, you know, clearly those in a female body during the witch trials were being persecuted, murdered, tortured, etc. But also, I think it's easy to forget that whilst that was happening to those in a female body, and the majority of those who died, I believe 85% of those who died were women, at the same time, those who loved those women were having to watch that. And that is, you know, horrific.
They felt threatened too.
Of course, but also, you know, bad enough being tortured and murdered, but imagine watching the woman that you love, the woman who is the mother of your children, or your mother, or your sister, or your daughter. Imagine watching her being tortured and or burned, or you know, whatever. In some ways, I actually think that's potentially worse, to be the one who survives, the one who saw it and who still gets to live. And that's the wound that the masculine is carrying around this, or that you know, the kind of male part of that story is carrying. And so there is this incredible fear around, basically around connecting with nature, connecting with our authentic capacity to be intuitive, connecting with our interwovenness with all things, connecting even with the animal kingdom. You know, any woman who was accused of witchcraft who had a pet, that pet was instantly, you know, called a familiar, a disgusting fetch, you know, not a beloved companion, oh cute my beagle, but an emanation of evil. You know, everything got so twisted. And I think that because what was being twisted was around heresy, and it wasn't, you know, if we look at the kind of historical facts, it wasn't just being heretical against the kind of the line from the church at the time. It was heresy against anything. And much of the heresy, really, if we're honest, was against the political and socioeconomic climate of the time. So it was the heresy of daring to suggest that you might have a right to put bread on your own table, or that you might have a right to work for your own family as well as for your landlord. Or even, you know, damn your eyes, a right to live on the land of your birth. It was, there's so much more to it than...
Well, what a lot came from enclosure, didn't it? The idea of enclosure.
Yes.
Well, that was back in the 12th century, but I think it started earlier even than that, because the more I've studied, the more I've talked with people of your ilk and people who are deep into the mysticism in the Bible, there seems to be this belief that the power of the woman was strong until we invented fences, because until then, a woman was needed to take care of the children, not just to take care of the children, but she was a powerful person in her own right. If a man lost his partner, he lost half himself. But once we had fences, children were required to do the work of the harvesting and the digging, and the wife could be replaced. So therefore, it became that the children, the heirs, were far more important because the woman could be replaced. Would that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense to me. And actually, the fencing of nature was part of how come the feminine and women's bodies in particular became so miserably repressed and,
fenced in courses.
Disrespected is because part of, apparently in Europe, not so much in the United Kingdom, but in the rest of Europe, congruent with the fencing of common land and with the removal of the capacity of the peasant classes, if you like, to make their own living and to make a good living on the land. So that, you know, that's what fences did, basically. They took away everybody's right, the common man and woman's right, to make a living from the land. And the fences enclosed the land, and the landlords basically said, this is mine, and you can only work on it when and where I say so. And congruent with that historically is the kind of unfencing of the feminine body. So whilst they were busy building fences all over the land and saying, this is mine and you can't do what you like here, they were dropping laws that had, if you like, fenced a woman's body. So, for example, in, I think it was France and Italy, whilst the enclosures were taking place, the crime of rape was taken from the statute books. So it was no longer a crime to rape a woman. And what happened was that the young men of the time who might usefully have been out, you know, planting something to eat, but no longer could because they had no access to land, used to go around in gangs and take unwelcome liberties with a woman's body, and there was no persecuting them. There had been previously no persecution for noblemen who did such things to women, but now it became possible for any man to do such things to women. And so with the enclosing and the taking away of the body of the earth, the body of women and of common women in particular became a thing that was kind of commonly used, as it were, as, and I think it was an absolutely cynical attempt to just make a situation whereby the feminine, in every sense of the word, whether it was the land or intuition or a woman's body, was only accessible by its denigration.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's horrific and it's fascinating. Enclosure, just in case you don't know about it, in the USA, was a law made by the king in the 12th century, that what had been a lot of common land, there was vast amounts of common land all over the United Kingdom and in Europe, where people could graze their animals and could grow a little bit, but mostly grazing their animals. They had sheep or ducks or whatever, and these people lived from that land, and then the land was taken into ownership by the lords and the squires on the gift of the king, and the people had a certain amount of time to claim for an area of that land. But of course, most people then were illiterate and they didn't even understand the notices that went out. So most people got absolutely no land whatsoever. And those who did claim the land only got the poorer parts of the land. So this was really a massive cruelty to the common people for the aid of wealth back in the Middle Ages. And that's one of the reasons why it was Dark Ages for many people. So moving on from that, Susie, because it's a terrible story, and it has stayed in the archetypes and stayed in our race memory, whether we believe in reincarnation or the Akashic record or whatever. It's come down through the DNA that the woman's body is not as valuable, whereas before the fencing, if the woman died, all the children died, full stop. Whereas after the fencing, the children were needed for work. What can we do to redress this now? Because I know you do a lot of shamanistic work to reclaim the soul. Can you explain that a little bit about that?
I think one of the major things we can do to redress it is to acknowledge that it's the case, and that as you just mentioned, these traumas, let's face it, they're catastrophes and traumas, have been passed down to us through our DNA. I'm sure that pretty much everybody listening is aware of the research that is taking place in science currently that says that if a human being suffers from, you know, shocking and traumatic events, then the shocking and traumatic events are passed on to their children in their kind of expectations of life through their DNA and bloodlines. And so all of us who have anything to do with any kind of witchy persecution, which that is, I want to be really clear, that's not exclusive to Europe. There are, you know,
Salem trials
for witchcraft taking place right now, this very moment, all over the world, in all kinds of places. And the denigration of the feminine. There's something horrendous percentage of the people in prison in Pakistan are women, and almost all of them are in prison because they are not the perpetrators, but the victims of rape. It's not something that's in our past only, it's in our present also, all over the world. And I think step one to transforming that is to acknowledge that it's the case, and that as soon as we acknowledge that, you know, yes, as a human being, I am part sacredly masculine and part sacredly feminine, and that both of these parts need to be honored in me, that we're taking a massive step into healing the wound that says it's not okay to be in connection, because that's one of the paramount aspects of the feminine, is that we love to connect and we are good at connecting, and our nurturingness and our intuition and our capacity to be receptive and to offer care are things that are, you know, incredibly important to our species and to our earth, and we need to offer that connection and care out to one another and out to the interwoven aspects of all that is. And as soon as we step into that place where we realize, I'm connected to life, I'm connected to everything, I'm part of everything, I think it changes everything. And if you're honoring that aspect of yourself, then the masculine aspect, which is there to protect, is going to stand up on behalf of life rather than standing up on behalf of the corporation, the most amount of cash and the most amount of power over. So somebody who is honoring both aspects of themselves is going to be all about the power of our indivisible interconnection with all of life, the power of love, the power of our capacity to heal, to change, rather than my power over you for my gain and I don't care about you, which is more of what we've got now.
One of the things you suggested that I did when I was sick, and I did do it, and it's one of those profound things that I'll remember for the rest of my life, you said was find a tree and go to that tree in the night, in the darkness, and just sit with that tree for as long as you can. Sit on the earth, feel the earth, put your back against the tree, and just let go. And it was a profound experience, Susie. And have you done that? Where did that come from? Where in the shamanistic knowledge is that?
Gosh, I have no idea. For me, that came from simply doing that. So from using the aforementioned intuition to go and be with a tree, because for me, the one of the fundamental tenets of shamanism is everything is made up of the same stuff and everything is connected. And so, you know, science and shamanism are completely singing from the same hymn sheet in this regard. It's clear that everything in all of creation is made up of this extraordinary same stuff, and that what makes the differences between us is basically the dance we're doing. So it's not that we are made of a different material, it's that whatever this stuff is doing a different dance in a tree than it is in a human being. And so, you know, maybe the tree's doing the cha-cha-cha, maybe the human being's doing the tango, maybe it's Berlioz versus Mussorgsky, who knows. You know, it's not just the dance, it's the music, it's the steps, it's the tempo, it's everything.
But it's the weave.
It's the weave, absolutely. But still, fundamentally, it's the same stuff. And so, therefore, we are related. And that, you know, the Native American Indians have this exquisite expression, all my relations. And by that, they don't just mean all the people on my patch of land or all the people within my lineage. They mean the rocks and the trees and the coyotes and the beagles, everybody, the plants, the rivers, the grass.
Well, it's also the spirits of the plants and the rivers. Susie, are they friendly to us or are they hostile? Because we've been raping the environment for a while. If you go out in the night in the darkness, are you going to meet friendly energies?
You are going to meet energy, which is neither friendly nor not friendly, because the energy that is behind all of that stuff, which is ultimately divine energy, is simply energy. And to my mind, that energy could as easily be called love. And so my quick answer to that question is yes, they'll be friendly, but actually they're not all going to be friendly, because they're not all super chuffed with, you know, the way we treat them. But ultimately, the energy behind all that is the energy of love, because it is the energy of that, you know, wonderful goddess that created everything. Did you call her the Elohim?
Elohim,
yes. Elohim. So I love that word. It's such a beautiful word. Mm-hmm. That everything, the everything that is vibrating in all these extraordinary different ways and is made up of the same stuff is contained of and contained in spirit. And that spirit wants to be. And so if we're going out there with our machete at a tree to chop it down, we're not very likely to be welcomed. If we're going out there to speak to trees of love and healing and beauty, we're going to be welcomed with open branches, as it were. And it's all about our intention. Our intention is so powerful.
I go out at night and I greet them and bless them and call down the highest blessing that they can possibly receive, and also ask them to protect. And it seems to work very well. I get this sort of sense, again, I'm not as sensitive as you, but I get this sense of presence. And sometimes I get questions when I'm gardening. I always try and alert the garden what I'm going to be doing. And sometimes I do get the sense of, why are you doing that?
Yeah, so everything is alive, everything has spirit, and that's so beautiful that you bring down blessings upon them. And actually, in answer to your previous question, to offer blessings is the most powerful and exquisite way to help heal the world, the paradigm within which we live, to make your life a more beautiful place, is to just offer your love, your blessings out to that which is in front of you, to which you are related, and to see it as, you know, potentially your friend, potentially an aspect of your beloved, which, you know, in many ways it is, because the earth essentially is our mother. You know, sadly we haven't had time to delve into the dark and beautiful realms of the goddess that sits behind all of creation, but she, you know, if we view her as our mother, then we also need to view the earth as ultimately our mother, and therefore to view her with so much love and so much respect, and to understand that, as mothers do, what she wants for us is that we be the very best, the most beautiful, the most potent version of ourselves that we can be. And it is deeply saddening to her when we are not that. And occasionally we might get a slap if we're really, really not being that.
Mm. One of the, Elohim is an almost impossible word to translate, and my guest next week, Steve Pope, is an expert in going into the spaces between the words in Hebrew. He's a Hebrew scholar, but he explains that the problem with the Bible and all the texts is they get set in stone, so we don't be in the movement. But Elohim means simultaneously stillness, movement, breath, and the mother waters. Isn't that beautiful?
Goodness, I'm glad I know that. So that perfect, exquisite, impossible balance between stillness and movement, between the polarizing aspects of life, to me, that's where all the magic is and where the divine lies. You know, again, science has investigated the nature of reality and discovered that, in fact, everything is constantly polarizing all of the time. That's how come we have material existence. It can only exist by this extraordinary constant polarizing, and that in between, you know, polarity by its very nature is opposites, but all of the teachings, and actually in particular the Celtic teachings, so the ancient teachings of these lands, say that yes, the world is made up of opposites, but also it's not either or in opposition, it's and yes. So we come to that exquisite sacred three that you talked about at the beginning. The three where you have this thing, its utter opposite, and the place where both of them are true, and so you get the Trinity. And all forms of the goddess in Celtic Britain are a Trinity. Always the goddess has triple nature, and that triple nature is, you know, life, death, and the place of both, if you like.
Yes, well, one of the purposes, I hope, of this program is to show that all of that, everything you're saying, was there in the Bible, was there in our traditional Christianity, is probably in Islam, certainly in Judaism, and is in Hinduism as well. And if we can reweave this from the very beginning, I think we have a chance of bringing environmental care as part of the faith and taking it into the major faith and helping people to see that the mother is part of that Trinity, and without the mother, we will die.
Absolutely. And by the sounds of it, all of that is contained in the word Elohim. Is just exquisite, you know,
and also the creation, the verb, the actual creating, it is constantly recreated in the now. That's how things like the law of attraction work, and it's very ancient teaching in that at every moment the Elohim recreates the earth. And the whole aspect of divinity is a consciousness that is holding creation and rebirthing it every single minute, which is why if you change your mind, if you change your belief, if you change your practice, things can change for you almost immediately because the universe is being reborn.
Absolutely. Yeah, born afresh in every second.
I've been yakking far too much, Susie. I should have let you talk more. In closing, would you have anything to recommend that people do to contact the divine feminine in them?
Go outside. Go outside. If you can, speak with water, present in that beautiful word, Elohim. Water, it seems, is very particularly keen, willing, able to be a conduit between all that is sacred and humanity. Listen to her, sing with her, allow her to take from you your griefs and your sorrows, and understand that, exactly as Maggie just said, the world can be reborn in a second. All you have to do is step forward and change your mind.